some details about hypothesis testing, specifically when we're comparing a mean to a fixed value. And the mean is from a sample or from a population. But let's take a look at both of those in turn. Now, hypothesis tests follow the procedure we outlined in a previous lesson of setting the null hypothesis, setting the alternative hypothesis, and then calculating a test statistic, comparing that to a critical value, which we may also need to calculate, and make a conclusion. Now, when we set up and design these tests, it's in part is to figure out, well, what's an acceptable sample size? And you can see within the formulas, there's usually an N for the number of samples. And you can solve for that value and back calculate, given the other parameters, what sample size would be appropriate. So as you look through these different formulas, look for doing a little bit of algebra to solve for the sample size. And it's a good exercise in general, given any kind of a confidence interval or a hypothesis test formula, because that's almost always the question that's going to come up in practice is, well, how many samples do I need? It's also easy enough to set up in Excel or use Minitab or something like that to determine your sample sizes. All right, the Z test, in Z is the same bit of information as the Z tables and the standard normal test. So this is dealing with the situation where I have a population mean and I'm comparing it to a fixed value. But it also has that I know the standard deviation from the population. Now, that's rarely the case, and more often we use what's called a t-test, which we'll get to in a moment. But take a look. It's got the x-bar, which is my sample mean of the value that I'm taking a value or a population that I'm taking a sample of, and I'm comparing that to mu, which is using that Greek character for a mean value. So that's the population mean. Now, we can also put in there that it's a part of our specification. We can use some fixed value. Now, the tricky part is, and what makes the z-test a little bit less useful, is we rarely know what the standard deviation is, the sigma sub x. But hence, we also don't know the standard error term, the sigma sub x bar. But we typically do know is an estimate of that, a statistic instead of the parameter. And so that's why we use the t-test. Notice the square root of n divided into the standard deviation, and that gives us the standard error term. And we can, using those four bits of data, or if you know the standard deviation of your means, their sample means, then you can use the sigma x bar. But anyway, we calculate out a z value, and it looks like it's very much in the same structure as when we do the conversion of our data so that we can use the standard normal table. And then on the left side, there's H sub 0, which is, or H sub O, is the null hypothesis, and H sub A, which is the alternative hypothesis. And there's three cases there. One where it's two-sided, where it's either null hypothesis equal or it's not equal is the alternative, or it's less than or it's greater than for the next two respectively. And it provides a way for us to prove the alternative of hypothesis if our test statistic is greater than our critical value. And let's use an example to go through that process real quick. So let's say I've got an existing process, and I know from the historical data that it has a population mean and standard deviation value. And what I'm looking for is we're going to make a change. We're going to run an experiment where we're going to create some of these plates, measure their thicknesses, and we want to determine if the change we made makes the plates thinner. So we run, looks like 8 values. And we calculate their mean, the x sub bar, and n is equal to 8, and mu sub 0 and x sub and sigma sub x, the standard deviation, are given. We know what those values are. So at this point, we have everything we need in order to run this calculation out. And I get there's my notes. Let me get my pen out. I'm trying to talk and read at the same time, and that doesn't usually work very well. So I get a value of, let's see, the X bar value of 7.75, which is less than the 7.8, so we're, at least we're heading in the right direction, but it's pretty close. So this is really going to depend on how big our standard deviation is. 0.16, it may not be enough data to show the change, but let's run the calculation out. And so if I do a quick drawing of this, I've got my sample, and I've got this 7.8 value, and my mean is at 7.75, and my critical value is 7.8. And let's see, I've got 0.16, so it'd be 9.11 would be one standard deviation. So I didn't really draw the distribution correctly, but I'm within one standard deviation of this. So I need some pretty convincing data, or a lot of data, to be able to tell the difference here. So with just a quick drawing, I have a sense that this is going to be tough to prove. Where on the other hand, if the distance between 7.75 and 7.8 was like 3 or 4 sigma, then I have pretty convincing evidence that something's different. It's very unusual for a sample to give me that much of a difference if there was no underlying change in the distribution. All right, so let me get rid of what I got on there. And if I run this calculation out, I get a Z statistic of minus 0.8839. Right? Mu minus 7.75 minus 7.8, well, that would give us a negative number, and dividing it out. So that makes sense. And for a one-sided alpha, for a one-sided test, because I'm only interested in, is it thinner? It's the clue there. I would say the null hypothesis is they're equal. The alternative hypothesis is I'm looking for it to be, the null hypothesis is that it's greater than that, and the alternate is that it's less than the mu sub zero. And so at least I'm heading in the right direction, but is it enough to be convincing? And so at a 95% confidence, that's alpha is 0.05, and it's just that lower tail of the distribution is what I'm interested in. So if I go to my standard normal table, it's going to give me the upper tail, and I want that area that is equal to 0.05, but I'm going to reverse that, put a negative sign in front of it to get it over to the opposite side. The table I have happens to show the upper tail is in the values provided. So the test that, or the critical value that I get from a standard normal table for 0.05 is a negative, because of the tail I'm looking for, 1.645. And that's my decision point. I need a value that's outside of that, so smaller in a negative sense. And my value is 0.88 or 0.89, which is closer to zero than the negative 1.6. So I do not accept my alternative hypothesis, and I can conclude that the process change did not result in any convincing reduction in plate thickness. All right, So hopefully that made sense. Let's take a look at a t-test, which I mentioned a few minutes ago. The same exact structure, but the biggest difference is that I have standard deviations here of the sample rather than the known population standard deviation. And so my standard error term and my standard deviation term are based on the sample. And it, with the last example, I only had 8 samples, so I'm going to be dividing by 7, n minus 1, instead of just dividing by n to get a standard deviation. So that's the biggest difference of it. I still set up a hypothesis structure, and I calculate the test statistic. This is the test statistic, and calculate the lookup or calculate the critical value and make a conclusion. All right, so let's take a look at I think it's the exact same data. I got lazy putting this together. But the big difference is I'm dealing now, I don't have a standard deviation term. I don't have the sigma sub x value. So I have to use this data to make that estimate. So I calculate out the standard deviation, and I get 0.09, if I do that correctly, 29. Pretty tight standard deviation. It's not too bad. It's less than the 0.16 that we used with the Z table. And so I ran out this calculation. I've got square root of 8. I've got this S sub X value here, or the S sub X value right there. And I've got a mean value that should be the same at 7.75 minus the 7.8. So I should get a negative number. And I'm calculating out a test statistic of 1.522. All right. And so for a one-sided from the t-table, using alpha equal 0.05 and degrees of freedom equal to 7, I get negative 1.895. So once again, it's closer, but I don't have convincing evidence that the plates are thinner. All right, so there was some advantage by having a smaller standard deviation, but at a 95% confidence, I don't have sufficient data to get there. And so even with a 90%, it's going to be closer to the 1.6, and still not quite there. Now, you could drop the confidence down and get below or get outside of that 1.5, but you're taking the risk that the sample we have, due to the random sampling, was artificially smaller than normal, that its ability to represent the population is reduced. And so we want to be careful with that. If we take more samples, you can see how it affects the calculation, and it allows us to get a larger t-statistic, given everything else is fairly constant, and that may give us enough evidence that there really is a change. All right, so those are two examples. But what's this have to do with reliability? Well, when I'm either making a change or making an observation or comparing to specification, whether it's internal production or from a supplier, we're often looking for, did the changes or the modifications or the improvements make a real difference? And we're involved with lots of different designs and different changes that are going to be occurring. And using a little bit of statistics allows us then to make sure that those changes are real, that they have a high probability of actually of having occurred. If we only take one or two samples or use nothing but engineering judgment, we may be fooled by the sparse data. And so it's one of the roles of hypothesis testing is to check those hunches and get sufficient evidence to show that your hypothesis is correct. And so That's one of the roles for it. In reliability wise, we can also not only test dimensions of plate thicknesses, we can measure time to failure information. Let's take two vendors' sets of components and run a life test and compare the time to failure parameters from one to the other and see if there's a real difference. Same basic idea, it's just different kinds of data. So we can use it for quality related areas or for the effectiveness of changes or process improvements and so on, or we can use it directly in the reliability testing. So in the next one, we're going to look at variances, the testing the change in the spread of the data.